sleep to the most. And reading the first couple of chapters where they're actually doing the census, I did fall asleep 3 times. So that's the way it goes sometimes. So I call it this session, The Story Continues, because it picks up kind of where the narrative of Exodus left off. We kind of got some law in Leviticus, and we have a mixture of law and story here in Numbers. So just putting this into the overall picture, you'll remember Genesis sets forth Israel's relationship with God, right? He created things. He became the founder of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and technically Joshua, but we didn't talk about that one. Or not Joshua. I did it again. I said Joshua instead of Joseph. And Joseph. Joseph is the other one. Exodus is then the story of how God redeemed his people out of Egypt and brought them out of slavery. Leviticus then gives instructions on how to worship God. And then we pick up with the historical narrative from there again. So the name Numbers, we get our name from Greek arithmoi. That's the way that they would say numbers. And it comes from the two censuses, or censi. I'm not sure how you say it, plural of a census. One in chapter 1, and then again in chapter 26, I think. The Hebrew name is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. And that's the first word again. But, you know, it's in the wilderness God spoke to his people and how they acted in the wilderness. So it's actually a more accurate name of what the entire book is about rather than Numbers. Authorship and date. We've talked before about how this is all attributed to Moses, how there's probably some editing by a couple of sources along the way. Moses, they put his date of birth in about 1526. Then he's 80 years old when he brings them out of Egypt in the Exodus. And then 40 years in the desert turns it into 1406, that the last events kind of at the end of the chapter would be. They're camped on the bank of the Jordan River. There we go. They're on the east side, about to go west. So they kind of go in a roundabout way. We'll look at a map in a minute that kind of shows what it is. But that puts those events in about 1406, give or take. So going back to the progression, Exodus technically ended with the construction of the tabernacle. That's the last thing that we get in Exodus. And then Leviticus kind of interrupts and tells us, this is how you worship at the tabernacle. And then Numbers picks up. They start again at the tabernacle at the base of Mount Sinai and how they're going to move from there. So why do we want to study Numbers? We have the history piece that we've already talked about. We also have a theological piece. We talk about in this further revelation of God, we really run into God's wrath for the first time. We run into the price of unbelief. So some big theological concepts. And then religious, there's even more given as to the religious custom of Israel and how Israel should interact with God. And so those are all reasons why we should be studying this, because they all kind of apply to what we believe, given that it's the same foundational, you know, the foundational document, the foundational, that's what I'm looking for. Not just document, but the precepts that we grew out of as Christians come from this same base. So that's why we look at this as well. So my slides are really off today. This says the big idea, but you can only read half of it. It's really about failure in the wilderness. They're out there in the middle of nowhere, and they continue to do things wrong, and they get punished for it. It's also kind of interesting, though, that the big idea of this is looked back on as the time that Israel should celebrate. Later, you know, when they have kings, they say, remember when you were out in the wilderness, and I took care of you, and I loved you? So even though this is about repeated failure and about repercussions of failure, it's also looked back on as a time to celebrate and as the ideal time of being with God.
I was just going to say, it kind of struck me as I was reading through it that this seems to be a common theme for the Israelites, that they're constantly looking back, because throughout all of Numbers, they're looking back to Egypt. Oh, wasn't it great in Egypt? Wasn't it wonderful in Egypt? So that then carries on, and this is considered, you know, for a longer portion of their time, the sweet period of their history.
here's one outline that kind of breaks down several different things. And I like this outline because it kind of puts chronologically a couple of things. Some people break it up into three parts, some people into five parts, but I've got it broken up here by kind of what's going on. So you've got Mount Sinai in the first 10 chapters, and then the journey from Sinai to Kadesh, and then the wilderness wanderings once they get to Kadesh and they decide that they can't go into the promised land. And then you have them camped on the plains of Moab, ready to go into the promised land. It's really about two generations, the old generation that comes out of Egypt, and then they all die off, except for two people. And then you have the new generation that gets to go into the promised land. It kind of breaks it up into time. You have a couple of weeks at the beginning, and then you have 38 years of that kind of middle part, and then a couple of months at the end as they're actually moving and preparing to go in again. And you can also break it up by what mountain they're at. So Mount Sinai, where they get the covenant, Mount Hor, where Aaron dies, and Mount Nebo, where Moses dies. So good connection with mountain and death there somehow. All right, and here's the map I promised you. So you have Ramses and Tapanhes, which are over there in Egypt, which is kind of we know that the Israelites helped build those cities. You have Mount Sinai down there at the very bottom of the Sinai Peninsula. And then you kind of have them potentially going up this way toward Kadesh, which is kind of up there by Edom. When they get to Edom, when they get to Kadesh, they're going to end up taking a right over to Edom, then north into Moab, and then they're going to cross the Jordan into the Promised Land. Instead of going up kind of a way that makes sense from Egypt, they're going to kind of go as far around as possible. All right. And then a note on the two censuses. I put the numbers there. You can see them if you want. But this thing that if there are actually 603,550 men eligible for war, that means a population probably around 2 million people, which is a spectacular number of people for that time period. And so some people take this as meaning, well, really there were 603 families, and then there were 550 leaders of that group. Some people say that each number is, as you go through numbers here, let me just pick one of them randomly. So they've got 59,300 people from the tribe of Simeon. Some people think that means that there were 59 commanders and 300 fighting men, which that's a lot of commanders for just 300 people. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to do that either. Some people actually think that means that there were 58 commanders and 1,300 fighting men. They have a formula that they apply that they got from other places in the Bible and extra-biblical literature, which would put it more in line with what you would expect of, rather than having 2 million people, it would be a much smaller population. But anyway, I think it shows one thing, and that is, God has been faithful to his promise. Do you guys remember the four things that he kind of promised back in Genesis to Abraham? What was one of them? Descendants as numerous as the sand on the, exactly, or as the stars, right? And so we're getting to the point here where we're seeing a fantastic number of people, and it kind of shows that God's promise is starting to come true. And you also have them preparing to enter the land by the end of the book. The other parts you have, God had said that there'll be a blessing to the nations, and they're coming into contact with other nations finally, other than Egypt. You also have the covenant relationship with God, that you will be my people and I will be your God. And that's highlighted here in Numbers by the pillar of cloud and fire, and you have the actual presence of God amongst his people. So it's kind of interesting that we're starting to see the kind of the four aspects of the Abrahamic covenant starting to be fulfilled here in Numbers. All right. With that, there was only one other thing I wanted to point out, and that is that there is only one direct quotation to Numbers in the New Testament, and that's in 2 Timothy 2:19. There are a lot of indirect references, but I thought it's interesting that in this one place they actually quote it. we don't get a lot of actual quotation of scripture. We get a lot of inference, but here it's a direct quotation. So with that, we're going to march through the book because there are a lot of stories, but and a lot of interesting little tidbits, but not really a big theme that we want to hit on. So we're going to start with chapter 5 and the bitter water.
So the ordeal of the bitter water is real weird. Basically what happens is if a husband suspects his wife of adultery or becomes jealous, he can bring his wife to the temple courts to undergo this trial. In practice, though, which is also strange to say in practice because we have no evidence that this was actually ever performed. But in practice, it's thought that the priest would give many opportunities for the woman to confess in front of the Sanhedrin, and if she did not confess, then she would have to undergo this thing, and if she did confess, she wouldn't. But there's obviously consequences to confessing, so, you know, I might just undergo the ordeal if I was innocent. And so basically what happens is the priest mixes together living water, which we've discussed last week, so basically like spring water, and then takes dirt from the temple court floor and mixes it together, and the woman has to drink it. And if she is innocent, nothing will happen to her. But if she is guilty, yeah, I see you cringing back there. It's kind of weird. If she is guilty, though, her belly will swell and rumble violently, and our most translations say, and her thigh will burst. I think we've talked about this before, but the thigh is almost always a euphemism for reproductive organs, male or female. So, like, we would take this as, like, her uterus would burst or something like that. It's really strange, really, really strange. So a couple things that are interesting to note is that this is the only law that requires divine intervention. It's not a super well-known trial, but amongst those to whom it is known, it's very controversial because some have said that this is God-endorsed abortion, being that, like, if she had an affair and she's guilty and becomes pregnant, like, she will not carry the baby to term and, like, defile the line, which obviously is a very, like, whoa, that's kind of terrifying. The interpretation that I think I ascribe to the most is that there is nothing in water mixed with dirt that would make your body explode. So it's likely that if this ever was done, and God, you know, if God intervenes, and because the person is guilty, then God intervenes, but it's likely that this wouldn't have done anything to anyone anyway. So a lot of people have thought that this was a trial to protect women, because, like, you know, in the ancient Middle East, we know that women were considered property and chattel, and if a husband grew jealous or suspected a wife of adultery, he had a lot of incentive to harm her and mistreat her and abuse her. But in our faith tradition, the women are not considered as much as property, and they're protected. And so this is thought to protect women by, if a husband has a suspicion, he has to bring his wife in front of his entire community and make her prove her innocence. And like we said, it's likely that nothing would happen if you drank water and dirt. So it's also thought that this is a way to protect women, which I like better than God-sanctioned abortions. So
have God's presence there in the camp, it makes sense, I guess, that you're thinking, well, if God is going to judge something, he can do it here and now because he's right here. I guess we can parallel that and say God is present in us through the Spirit and Jesus, but I'm not going to suggest that we do this one. I'm not going to say it's a modern practice here.
No, I think it's good.
Yeah, I would
go out on a limb on that one.
I would kind of note that if this was something that they did do, and if it was genuinely working, I don't know that it should necessarily sway us one way or the other on the topic of abortion, just because if you look at the Old Testament, you do have other instances of God leading to, you know, the death of a child. You think of David and Bathsheba, right? They have, and this almost harkens back to it, right? Because she, through coercion and other things, David has an illegitimate child, and God says, you're not going to get to keep that child. So I think there's more than one way of looking at this other than just, you know, obviously we know scientifically it wasn't a magical formula. They could just go to the temple and say, like, hey, you know, give me that bitter water. So.
I imagine that this would not have been undertaken lightly, because there's also evidence that, like, the woman would have to, like, rip her clothing, and, like, her chest would be exposed, and, like, her hair was let down, which are all symbols of shame. And I imagine falsely accusing your wife and having her undergo that is not grounds for a good marriage. And so I also feel like maybe this was, like, the severity of this was to encourage right relationship with people in general, and to honestly maybe encourage men to not become violent with jealousy, and for women to honor their husbands, and so who knows.
Any other thoughts?
Exactly, because I also imagine that if a husband was proven, like, that he had no grounds for anything that he was saying, I imagine that would be very shameful for him. So, I think, yeah.
No, of course not. We get a pass. There's the general Levitical law in chapter 18, but it, that is more about, there is one for adultery, and then it's expanded a little bit. It says it's on their heads in chapter 20, 22, whatever it was. I forget what it was. So there is kind of a punishment, but it's not, because it's a male-dominant culture, it's not really, yeah, it's more a slap on the wrist in that sense.
Yeah, as we move on to number six, we get into the Nazirite vow. And the Nazirite vow, so it comes from the term Nazir, which just means set apart. It's just kind of another word for holy or different. And as I researched this, I have more questions than answers. I don't know how a Nazirite vow started. If you look at number six, God says, when someone takes a special vow, a Nazirite vow, but he doesn't say, here's instructions for a vow that I'm giving you. It's like, if you're doing this thing that already is existing, here's how it can be done. I don't even understand. understand necessarily the why. So you're setting yourself apart. You're kind of marking yourself as different than others. But other than that, I can't necessarily find the purpose. Some of the things that, you know, we've probably all been over before, but just to go over them again, the vow meant that you weren't going to have any grapes, either dried or fresh. You're not going to have any wine. You're not going to have any fermented things. You weren't even going to have any vinegar that was made from other sources. No dead things. So even if your parents or your siblings died, you were not allowed to go near them. You weren't to touch them. You weren't to bury them. In fact, if somebody died near you, so if I was just standing here and Jay just died near me and I had a Nazarite vow, I had to go make two offerings, both the guilt offering and the sin offering to make up for that. So it was somehow a sin on the Nazarite's part if someone near them died. And then there was no hair cutting. Some of the commentaries I read, though, said that if their hair was a bother, they could cut it once a year. If it was a bother, there was a certain time of the year that they could cut it. So maybe a little bit grace there. We see different instances of Nazarite vows in the Old Testament. You have Samson, of course, probably the one that we hear about the most. Not very good at following that Nazarite vow, as we know. He had fermented things, and he touched dead things all the time, and cut his hair eventually, which was his, of course, you know, calling. And then you have Samuel, who's, and the interesting thing about the two of them is neither of them take up the Nazarite vow themselves. They're both born to women who were barren before that, and they make a vow to God that, like, if you give me a child, they'll be set apart, they'll be a Nazarite. And so both of these people follow this vow out of obligation. And then in the New Testament, you have John the Baptist. And some people think that maybe Jesus followed the Nazarite vow. I don't necessarily see a lot in there for that. I mean, he did turn water into wine, so unless he also didn't drink it.
Raised the dead.
Yeah, he raised the dead.
The ultimate subversion of expectations.
But can it be considered dead if Jesus is raising it? That's really the question. But yeah, again, I would love to know if anyone has any thoughts on the Nazarite vow, just because there wasn't a lot there as to its origins or its purpose, other than that you do it specifically to be set apart. Yes, a Nazarene, someone from Nazareth. Yeah, anybody could take the Nazarite vow. We just have instances of men doing it, at least as far as we understand in Scripture. Any other thoughts? Well, as we sat to do class, did you have something on 6 through 10? Because I looked at our list and I went, oh, we crossed out 9.
No, we crossed out
10.
All the...
It's
just the start of
11.
The story of moving on, so...
Yeah, so we kind of covered that in the intro, which is in chapter 10, they move on and they keep moving, and we get back to a little bit of narrative. In Numbers 11, we have something that I can't entirely wrap my mind around. The Israelites are complaining because all they get to eat is bread. And again, as an Italian, I can't quite understand that. Sounds great to me. So the people complain, and this is one of those first instances that Jay talked about where we see God's anger and wrath. So it says that the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. So God's mad. God's very mad. And a lot of the commentaries I read said he's just mad that they're complaining. Like, again, they are complaining to him. He's providing for them. He's taking care of them. He's, you know, they've done these censuses. They've got numbers. Yet they're still complaining. So you kind of have this back and forth between the people and Moses, and eventually elders are appointed to aid Moses. So they choose 70 men of Israel to be the elders and to be like officers over the people. And then Moses goes again to God, kind of like, hey, you know, maybe we can do something for these people. And God sends quail, but this is interesting to me because I don't think we really talk about it all that much. He also sends a plague. So it says Lord sprang up and it brought up quail, a wind from the Lord sprang up. It brought quail from the sea and let them fall beside the camp. So basically the people rose, they gathered all the quail, they ate all the quail. But it says, while the meat was yet between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck down the people with a very great plague. So any of those who were like really, really complaining, I guess, got to enjoy the flavor, but not really to consume it. And I don't remember talking, you know, in all of your children's Bibles, it's got the bread falling from heaven and the quail running through, and I don't remember the quail being a particularly negative story in children's school, but if you look at it here, it's just another story of the Israelites complaining. Do you have anything, Jay?
No, I would just add that we do see God still providing for his people,
yes,
but this time it seems to come at a cost, which is unusual so far.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? Okay, in Numbers 12, you have a little bit of a sibling tiff. You have Moses being opposed by Aaron and Miriam. So they come to him, and it starts in verse 1. It says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? A lot of the commentaries I read said that this might have had something to do with nationality, that this was his wife who was kind of different than them. She wasn't an Israelite, and there was a little bit of jealousy or anger over that sort of thing. But there was also a bit of, if you remember, we just talked about the 70 elders that were appointed. Some of the traditions or commentaries said that she kind of affected that choice that Moses made as to the 70. Like maybe he said, I think it should be this 70. And she was like, well, I don't really like those certain people, so let's do these ones. And so there was also a little bit of a question about Moses' management style and his ability. There was a separate incident that I was reading about that they said, well, this might have been something that they were complaining about. Anyway, God hears them complaining to Moses, and he comes down in a pillar of a cloud and says, this is the guy I chose, you know, what's your gripe, essentially. And then the only way I can think to describe it is God kind of goes off in a huff, you know, because it says the pillar of the cloud came down and stood at the entrance. It speaks to them. It says, why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. So he criticizes them, he rebukes them, and then he departs. And lo and behold, they look down, and Miriam has leprosy. It says that she was white as snow. Aaron, for some reason, is fine.
I'm assuming because he's the high priest and is been told he can't be ceremonially unclean, and so I'm assuming that he is unaffected for that reason.
Yeah, still interesting that he gets off scot-free, you know. Anyway, so she's got leprosy, and Aaron and Miriam are kind of like, Moses, no, what has happened to us? Which I think is weird, because God's the one who did it. But Moses cries to God and prays to him and says, oh, you know, forgive Miriam, forgive her, and God says, okay, but she should be embarrassed of herself for challenging you in such a way, so send her outside of the camp for 7 days, and she's got to remain there, which was, you know, the place where unclean people went. And so she had to stay outside the camp for 7 days, and then she got to come back. And double-checking my notes here, that was basically all. So you have this instance of siblings getting mad at their older sibling, and or their other sibling, and Miriam gets struck with leprosy and then has to leave the camp, comes back, and she's okay.
I do want to add one thing. It's shortly after this that you start getting mentions of Eleazar, the next high priest. And so I'm wondering, he starts appearing, it says, give it to Eleazar, like give him the trumpet, or I forget what it is, but Eleazar starts doing things before Aaron dies. And so I wonder, he just kind of appears, and I wonder if that's potentially the punishment that Aaron is getting is, hey, you're being replaced at this point. Just speculation on my point. I don't have anything beyond that.
Any other thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
soft punishment, behind the scenes punishment rather than a public punishment. Anything else?
In the version that I read, it says that if her father had but spit in her face, shouldn't she not be shamed 7 days? So essentially it's saying if something so simple as her father, you know, spitting on her was going to ostracize her for a while, then she should be ostracized now. It wasn't an instruction for her father to do that. Mm-hmm. And we move on to 13 and 14.
Got to get to Balaam's donkey, y'all. So I'll just do this real quick. So basically, they go and scout the land because they're at a point where they can enter the land. And so 12 representatives go, and they scout for 40 days and 40 nights. They're supposed to report back on everything. They bring a bunch of fruit back, and the fruit's real good because the land's real good. But we have 10 of them who are like, oh, no, there's scary people there. And so they give a faulty report, being like, we can't go. We can't do it. Which is bad, because then God is angry, and he's like, all of you who saw all my miracles in Egypt, you will not see Canaan, or, you know, the land. You will not inherit the land, which is why we get that Moses isn't allowed for a different reason, but all of the people of his generation are not allowed to go. This story is also important because it shows us, like, Joshua becomes the heir apparent to Moses here. An important little part we thought we needed to point out.
It also tells us why a journey that, by all standards of the time, should have taken between 4 and 6 weeks to get from the middle of Egypt to the middle of the Promised Land. So why it takes 38 years for them to get there, or 40 years to get there. So it's kind of interesting that we then have this, well, now I'm going to lead you through the desert, and you're just going to, we're going to exist out here, and it's going to be nice, but it's not what I promised you in the beginning, but that's the punishment. So,
well, so basically after this, the people, whenever they hear that the land is not good, they start rebelling and they're crying, because I would hate if I like went on this really long journey and then people are like, oh, well, we can't actually do what we set out to do. That's really sad. So they rebelled. God gets angry. Moses is like, no, don't punish them. And God is like, oh, okay, fine. These stiff-necked people will not see Canaan. So we see the same cycle that we've seen repeated many times in Leviticus and Numbers.
Yeah, and then we get a little bit more law, and then we get a little bit more narrative of them going on, and then we get to tithing. And we've talked a lot about tithing throughout this class, so I don't have anything new necessarily to add. One thing that I did find interesting was that the Levites were also to tithe of their tithe. In fact, it says, like, a tithe of your tithe. So I just thought it was interesting that this is something that God expects, like, all the people to take care, even those who are receiving the tithe, there to then give a tenth of that back to God. And then we get to move on to probably the most fun story in Numbers.
Yeah. Well, before we get there, chapter 20, they have now left. They are on their way. Everyone from the old generation has died, and this is the new generation. And you get the story with the water from the rock, which is the reason that Moses isn't allowed to enter the Promised Land. It's because instead of just speaking to the rock, he hits it with the staff. He was supposed to take the staff with him to the rock. He was just supposed to stand there with it and talk to the rock. But instead, he makes a demonstration that's against what God had told him to do, and that's the punishment is that you're not going to get to enter the land either, Moses. You also have the death of Aaron in this chapter, and I only mention it because we have Miriam dying and Aaron dying. most people attribute their punishment of not being able to enter the land to their rebellion against Moses. So just wanted to point out those because they're significant story points, I guess. Chapter 21, you've all heard the story of the bronze serpent. I only wanted to raise it here because we talked about it a little bit when we were doing the Genesis class, because it was as we were talking about the serpent in the garden and such and the significance of the bronze in that. And there was this parallel that I liked and I wanted to reiterate that you have anyone who looks at the bronze snake that's been lifted up over the people is cured of their of the poison of being bitten by one of the snakes. And we have the kind of the same thing with Jesus that I like, that Jesus is raised on a cross and whoever looks to that cross is saved from their sin. I like that allegory there. So I just wanted to reiterate that. And then we have Balaam, which is actually the longest story in all of Numbers and kind of one of the most obscure at the same time. How many of you know the story of Balaam? All right, how many of you know anything other than he had a talking donkey? All right, that's what most people know. They're like, oh yeah, Balaam, he's got a donkey. So let me give you the short version instead of the four-chapter version or three-chapter version. The Israelites have come through the wilderness. They've defeated a couple of local kingdoms, small kingdoms, and are camped on the outskirts of Moab territory. So they're kind of in the northeast getting ready to go into Moab, which is directly across the Jordan River. Moab's king Balak was afraid of the Israelites and engineered a coalition with a group of people called the Midianites that show up repeatedly. He sent representatives to Balaam by name. He said, go look for Balaam. So he's seeking his aid and cursing the Israelites. Balaam receives his messengers and asks them to stay the night so he can consult with God. God comes to Balaam in a dream and says, send the messengers away. And Balaam wakes up and says, I can only do what God says. I have to send you away. So Balak, the king, gets angry and sends a bigger, more lavish delegation with the promise of greater financial reward. And Balaam again says, all right, stay the night. I'll see what God says. And this time, God says, go ahead and go with him. So Balaam saddles his donkey and leaves with two of his manservants for Moab. It's unclear whether they're with the Moabites or if they are on their own following after the Moabites. Somewhere along the way, though, it becomes clear that God is angry with Balaam for going to Balak and the Moabites, even though he had just said, go ahead and go. It's unclear why that is. So just pointing that out. So God sends his angel, and this is the first occurrence we have of the Satan in the Old Testament. So there are a couple of things that we can talk about with that. We can talk about Satan, or we can talk about Balaam, or we can talk about both as we go forward, but because Satan in the Old Testament is fascinating. I'll just come clean. I don't believe in Satan as a matter of entity, but there's one small problem with that, in that Jesus recognizes Satan, so I understand I may be a heretic on that point, but I think it's worth talking about. Anyway, Balaam goes, and the donkey, of course, sees the angel that turns him aside, and he gets mad at the donkey and starts hitting it, and the donkey talks, and then God opens Balaam's eyes, and he's able to see the angel as well, the Satan. So then he goes over, and he meets up with King Balak, and he's overlooking the Israelite camp, and he says, all right, let's offer some sacrifices. They offer sacrifices, and he ends up blessing the Israelites, and Balak gets mad. He says, I brought you here to curse the Israelites. Let's do this again. Let's go over here to this other side where you can see the camp even better, and we'll do it again. And again, he ends up blessing the Israelites. And he ends up blessing them four times, actually. And then, finally, Balak is fed up with Balaam blessing the Israelites. He's like, fine, just go away. So our first question was, is Balaam a good guy or a bad guy? Is he a hero or a villain or something in between? Right. But I meant for purposes of this story. Any thoughts? I mean, he seems like a good and faithful servant, right? He's done exactly what God has told him to do, with this potential exception of God being angry that he went, but we're not sure why. We also have the fact that everywhere else in the Bible that Balaam is mentioned, he's mentioned as a bad guy. Later here in Numbers, in Jude, he's mentioned, and he's a bad guy. So why is he a bad guy if he's doing the right thing, apparently? You guys are going to love this. Was it in Numbers 30 or 31?
Let's see. One of the two.
Yeah, I can't remember offhand.
Early chapter 30. It gets really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's in...
it's in 31.
31.
Yeah. So what we see is that Moses is getting ready to go to war with the Midianites and the Moabites, and one of the Israelite soldiers brings home a prostitute or a woman from another nation. And a plague breaks out, and it's blamed on Balaam. And so it's when the Midianites are defeated, finally they're like, aha, we got Balaam back for that. And it turns out that Jewish tradition holds that Balaam acted as God's emissary in the blessings, but when he went, okay, so I can't sorcerer or curse them or whatever he was going to do, so what we'll do is I'll use my wit, my intellect, my non-godly gifts to try to subvert this blessing, and that he had instructed the Midianites and Moabites to set up prostitutes along the way, and 29,000 Israelites end up dying before they ever go to battle of basically venereal diseases. So it's interesting because Balaam is presented as a good person, but he's got such a bad reputation later. And really, you got to read into it a little bit to see that. So,
yeah, it's not the only instance, but I also find it interesting as I think about growing up in American culture, where there's always this like, oh, you know, we're so over-sexualized now. But if you look back, like their downfall at one point was the fact that they couldn't like control their own desires. Even the army people couldn't, right? So
let's talk about Satan for a minute. Because we have a couple minutes. We have like 2 minutes that we can do that with. Well, I guess we should move on to this little head daughter. We'll talk about Satan another time. How's that?
So the book of Numbers closes. There's a part in chapter 27, and then the last chapter includes this little tidbit on Zelophehad's daughters. Basically, there's a guy named Zelophehad who was not involved in the rebellion of Korah. And it says, the text says that he died of his own sin, which makes some people believe that this was the man who picked up sticks on the Sabbath and was put to death. So he had 5 daughters and no sons, and therefore he has no inheritance in the land that they will come to inhabit. So his daughters, 5 of them, come, and they're named, which is really important, come before Moses, and they say, hey, there, our dad died, and he has no sons, and therefore we'll have no inheritance, and therefore our dad's name will be completely forgotten forever. And Moses eventually does like grant them that they can have their father's inheritance. And then the secondary like conclusion of that is that the men from their tribe, Manasseh, I always have a hard time saying that name, they are like, no, but if they marry people from other tribes, then that land will go to other tribes. And so Moses then says, okay, daughters of Zelophehad, you have to just marry within your tribe. You can marry whoever you want, but you have to marry within the tribe so that the land stays in the tribe. So that's how the story goes. It's really important, though, because it shows that these women knew the law, and they saw a deficiency in the law. And where women would often stay at their tents and stay with their family, they left their tents and their family and went before Moses, which is very unusual. And they very wisely and astutely made their argument before him. And that argument is honored. It's found to be valid, and they honor it. And they change the law forever to include what happens to your property if you have no sons to leave it to. So it's very important.
Yeah, and then as we wrap up, we're kind of doubling back. So you have have like a portion that references the daughters, and then it ends with the daughters. But in 35, we have the refugee camp, as it's called. Very little interesting portion of scripture in that if you accidentally kill somebody, God gives instructions to them. When you set up, you know, in Canaan after you cross the Jordan, set up 6 cities, and if someone accidentally kills someone, they can flee to these cities, and they're good. They get to stay there, no judgment. They don't, you know, they can't be attacked, or no vengeance can come upon them. Now, if they leave the city, if they go just outside of the city borders, if someone comes for vengeance, it's fair game. But there were very specific instructions as to what accidentally killing was. So if you hit someone with a piece of iron, like you should know that that's going to kill them. Even if you hit someone with a piece of wood, which could kill them, you're considered a murderer. If you push somebody out of hatred, you're considered a murderer. If you just push them, I don't know how else you can push somebody. But really, this kind of just, there's a lot of specific instructions as to when you're considered an accidental killer versus a murderer. And a lot of it had to do with rage and just your anger and how it was. But basically, they would go to this camp, and they had to stay there until the high priest died. And once the high priest died, they were good. They got to come back. But it was sort of ostracization. If you think about, like, what they used to do to pirates, where, like, they would maroon them, this is sort of that. But it does raise some interesting questions, like what happens if someone kills someone in the city of refuge? What happens then? But
maybe they go to another city.
They go to one of the other 6 cities of refuge. But that's kind of where we end Numbers and wrap up. Then we get into.
So next week we're going to start with Deuteronomy, and we're going to slow back down again and really look at it, because it impacts Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, Ruth, are all based kind of on what happens in Deuteronomy. So we'll slow down there. And if you want to talk about Satan, I actually wrote a paper on it for my master's degree, and you can read it here because I brought it with me. So,
maybe our next class.